Welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Our guest today is historian and Harvard College professor Ann Blair. She's talking with us by telephone about her book, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Information Age, published by Yale and awarded the Choice Outstanding Title for History in 2011. Hello, Ann.
Hi.
It's great to have you on the show. We've been hearing, at least since the days of Marshall McLuhan, that we live in the information age, a time when we sometimes seem to be drowning in information, both as a society and as individuals. If the 70-some messages I counted arriving in my email yesterday before lunch are any indicator. And we read all the time about efforts to try to manage all this information we create and collect. Two of the major stories in the news are the billions of dollars the NSA is spending sorting all the information we didn't even know they were collecting by eavesdropping on our communications. And of course, much of the administration's problems rolling out the new health insurance system have to do with organizing heaps of data. And we often hear the term information overload, that there's so much information created moment to moment that we can't possibly keep track of it or put it to much use. And we tend to assume that this is something new, you know, that it's unique to our time. But the notion of information overload does have a history, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The substitute term, really, for the early modern period to information would be books, say. So the idea of a multitudo librorum, which can mean just a straight abundance of books in a good way. But then when people complain about it, I tend to translate it as an overabundance of books, is certainly a theme that is widespread starting from the mid-16th century, about 100 years after the invention of printing in the mid-15th century. But you could argue that even before that, we have authors responding to what they perceive as more books than you can read, offering you, therefore, what I call reference books, another anachronistic term, that is, books that bring you the best parts of those books you don't have access to or don't have time to access yourself. And really, I would say the modern reference book was born in the 13th century. So some reference books are born from what one might call underload, right? The idea that you can't find the books and therefore you want someone who has access to books to summarize them for you and so on. But a lot of these books, especially in the printed era, start by explaining that the problem is there are too many books, and you won't have time to read them. All you men of action, politicians, or busy scholars, and therefore we bring you trots, really, summaries, excerpts, and so forth for your convenience. So the term information is a modern one. Although it existed in the early modern period, it meant things like, you know, spies were men of information and so on. Specific information rather than this global idea of information that we work with today. And this idea of the information society that we live in can really sharply be dated to the early 1960s. But in opposition to the idea that we think of ourselves as an information society, something quite new, I think all societies have information, even if they don't have printing, even if they don't have writing.
Yes.
You know, information has been stored in all kinds of ways, in people's memories, in stories that are told and retold, obviously in manuscripts, and, you know, whether it's clay tablets or papyrus rolls or medieval manuscripts on parchment, and then, of course, in print. But print doesn't cut out those other media for information storage. So even today, you know, there's a certain amount of stuff that's in my brain. There's stuff that I say to people that doesn't get written down. There's stuff that's in manuscript, on post-it notes, very important, those things. Lists of things to do, and then there's stuff that gets into electronic form, like email, etc. Then there's stuff that gets written down in order to be printed, and or there's stuff that gets written down in order to be published online. So we all live with all kinds of layers of information, and I think it doesn't take a whole lot, really, to give an individual human the sense of, oh, there's too much to handle. And, you know, when you think of, say, Girolamo Cardano, the 16th century doctor who's, you know, seeing patients, has like three or four books in press at any one time, writing letters to dozens of correspondents around Europe, and doing this without a computer and a word processor and so on, you know, you can easily imagine how they felt overload too. Looks for shortcuts, some of which he describes, you know, as not reading books all the way through, but marking the passages that are difficult and you want to read again. And even most hilariously, he talks about writing books by cutting up books you have written, I think yourself, but didn't really specify, and pasting the paragraphs in a different order so you can get yourself a new book. So that's an extreme kind of shortcut, which is, I think, you know, a response to certain individuals' perception. I think that what's new about today is the sense that everyone experiences the vastness out there through the web. You know, it doesn't any Google search practically will get you, you know, way more hits than you could possibly read.
Millions of hits, almost.
Millions of hits. So, even for the smallest, most specific thing, it seems. Yeah. And yet, in all that, isn't it the case that we all find that we can't find what we're looking for?
Well, that's part of the problem. There's so much to sort through.
Right. And I suppose, so there's also, even as there's overload, there's underload. You know, there's not what you want at various points. Of course, I can't even barely remember how we worked before the internet. It's fantastic to have so much at your fingertips so rapidly. But it does create special challenges. There's no doubt about that.
So electronic technology is what's triggered the present-day information overload, at least in the way we conceive of it. So was it printing that caused this sort of abundance of reference materials to be published?
Well, certainly printing is the factor that the authors of the time refer to. Mm-hmm. They see it as, you know, it's called a divine invention. It's also called infernal in some quarters. And that's certainly a factor. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want a technologically deterministic interpretation, though, because printing doesn't have to have that impact. And in other cultures, say in China, printing was invented in the 8th century, and it did not result in a sudden outburst of book productions in different genres and so on. So I think the reason that we get so many reference books in print talking about print is, of course, that they are using the medium and, of course, contributing more books the overload, but theirs are good books, obviously. They're helping you cope with overload, as opposed to all those bad books or those books that are too many. So no author thinks their own book is excessive, obviously. But I think what is behind it, really, behind that special use of print, is an accumulative mentality. I don't know exactly what to call it. I call it infolust in some parts of my book. Mm-hmm. And it takes many forms. And I think there is something new about the 15th century, between humanism and recovering texts of antiquity, and not just texts, but statues and inscriptions and a sense of archaeology almost. And then you have the voyages of discovery, discovering really unheard of, unthought of worlds with a whole new potential for fauna and flora and people that would be very different potentially. There's an excitement about that. And there's a desire to stockpile information. When you come across something, you hoard it, you write about it, you publish it, you write about it in manuscript, perhaps, but you save it. Mm-hmm. And then the other factor in there, I think, is a special trauma of the early modern period, this awareness of the tremendous loss of ancient learning.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to ask about that. There seems to be an awareness that a lot has been lost that triggers this fear that what we have now is going to be lost, too, unless we do something about it, isn't there?
Absolutely. And you can get that very explicitly. I love this quote from an early 17th century Frenchman named Nicolas Fabry de Peyresque, who was one of these massive correspondents, but he never published anything. But he left tons and tons of manuscripts, his letters, of course, but all kinds of notes, reports from people he hired to go off and find out information for him, and his own reading notes. And his biography was written by Pierre Gassendi, who's pretty well known as a philosopher, sort of who Christianized Epicureanism in the early 17th century. And so here in English translation, describing how Peyresque worked, he says, Peyresque was most diligent in writing down any notable thing that came into his mind or was suggested by some other or observed in reading, because he could never endure that the least invention or observation of any man should be lost, being always in hopes that either himself or some other would be advantaged thereby. Therefore, he wrote things down in his memorials because he then judged they were out of danger of being forgotten. So here's someone who is worried about forgetting, about loss, not just for himself, but for others, because he's at this a node of correspondence. And so he keeps all this stuff in order to share it. Oh, so-and-so said, here's an example of that. letter by letter, sort of an information node, really. An intelligencer is a 17th century British term that was used to describe people like Henry Oldenburg, Secretary of the Royal Society, who played a similar role.
It's a nice word. It's too bad we can't bring it back.
We can always try.
So can you describe some of the major types of reference works that, you know, occupied compilers and publishers in the early modern period, and maybe talk about how they compare with our own encyclopedias and dictionaries on that kind of thing?
Right. So the dictionary is a pretty stable genre, really. You know, a list of words with explanations, and as they grow with examples, citations of people who used said word. The 13th century, really, in the medieval period, is the first time we get alphabetized dictionaries. The Catholicon by Giovanni de Balbi, for example, which is printed, one of the early books to be printed by Gutenberg, in fact, in the 15th century. Mm. So you can see that a medieval dictionary from the 13th century is still seen as an active book in use in the 15th. Then there are other dictionaries that take over. So 1503 by Ambrosio Calapino is one that has the longest life and probably the broadest diffusion. And it was so well diffused that really the word, French word calepin, for a little notebook, is, I think, derived from that book you always want to have at hand. Although in its early forms it was a large folio, so it's not exactly the same thing as a calepin. But I think that it is that the Calapino Dictionary is thought to be at the origin of that term. And the Calapino Dictionary went through, you know, like 185 editions over 300 years, roughly, changing a lot of its content, growing always. And it started off as a Latin dictionary, which is, of course, what the dictionaries all were in the Middle Ages, too, basically, mm-hmm. to which were added various vernaculars. So, you know, English and French and German and Dutch and Spanish and so forth. And then Greek, of course, and Hebrew. So these are not so much active vernaculars as classical languages for the early modern Europeans of Western Europe. But so it got up to 11. It was the Dictionarium Octolinguarum. So that's a genre that looks familiar, actually, surprisingly, perhaps. And it doesn't give pronunciations, but it does give basic grammatical info, just like our dictionaries do today.
Are there genres that fall by the wayside that are sort of developed that seem to work for the time that we wouldn't recognize quite?
Absolutely. My favorite is this giant collection of basically examples of human behavior called the Theatrum Humanae Vitae, the Theater of Human Life. The first edition was in 1565 at about 1.5 million words, and it is expanded by its original author, Theodor Zwinger, to 4.5 million words by 1586, and then it's the object of a sequel, which is by a Catholic cleric, whereas the original author was Protestant, so partly the sequel is about making it safe for Catholics, but it's also about expanding it wildly by another factor of two, basically, to a work called the Magnum Theatrum of about 10 million words. And this collects, under alphabetically arranged headings, little paragraphs that describe either quotables, sort of memorable statements made by people, but not just the statements themselves. They're always packaged with a story that explains the context, and that's the exemplum. You can get the example of virtue rewarded or vice punished, or examples of people who committed suicide in these various ways, or examples of all kinds of behavior, good and bad. And this is the idea that these examples will, I suppose, first of all, instruct you how to behave and how not to behave. And secondly, of course, they are at the ready for your use in things that you might be writing or saying, your conversation, your sermons, your letters, your treatises, arguments of any kind, is the point, can be stocked from this book. Something there for everyone. So that's really a genre that I don't see a ready equivalent to in the modern period. Nonetheless, the idea of storing things under headings, you know, and so the florilegium, which is storing sentences or sententiae or famous sayings by important people under topical headings, does live on quite well. Quotes.com or whatever. Yeah. Of course, Bartlett's Quotations would be the 19th century iconic modern genre that in the U.S. has a huge diffusion and many imitators and so on.
Yeah, and then miscellanies. Do we have anything corresponding to those?
Well, in a way, so I think we do. Yep. Because you could think of the internet as a giant miscellany, right? Because typically we historians have been most interested in two ways of organizing things, and they have contrasted the alphabetical order that I talked about for dictionaries. It's already there in the 13th century. or actually in the headings of the Theatrum, for example, or the Florilegium, are also alphabetically arranged, mm-hmm. versus a systematic order, which mm-hmm. would be an order in the way things hang together. Mm-hmm. And that is the order which is followed by a work that first uses the title encyclopedia to describe something that's a large collection of information, which is a reference book, I'd say. Before then, the term encyclopedia is used, but not directly very often in connection with a genre that we would identify as encyclopedic. But nevertheless, a couple early encyclopedias use the term, but they're systematically arranged, right? Yeah. So they'll start with the liberal arts, grammar, rhetoric, dialectic. Then you'd have the quadrivium with arithmetic and geometry and astronomy and music. And then you'd move on to the university disciplines of philosophy, logic, ethics, natural philosophy, and metaphysics. And then you move on to law and medicine and theology, right? So that's your canonical division into disciplines, which mm-hmm. is the main way of organizing something systematically in the early modern period.
Yeah, and...
But there is third order. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just to say, the Britannica in its last printed edition had a section that had a topical arrangement that had,
yes,
you know, that
well,
classification
actually,
scheme. Yeah,
five has the Propedia in addition to the Micropedia, mm-hmm. alphabetically arranged in small articles. The Macropedia, large articles alphabetically arranged. The mm-hmm. Propedia is this one volume that I don't think has a life in the electronic Britannica. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much attention it's gotten. It seems sort of barely used. I remember in the days of reference rooms where you could judge by how summed a book had been. The Propedia was Mortimer Adler's vision of how the disciplines fit together. He divided mm-hmm. them into 10 main fields. They were arranged in a circle, you know, around a center. And that's exactly speaking to the false etymology of encyclopedia that the word has lived with for centuries, since the Renaissance, as if it were a cycle or a circle. Mm-hmm. Whereas, in fact, the real etymology of encyclopedia, according to classicists, is that it comes from encyclios paideia, general education. Yeah. So encyclopedia is really about knowing a little bit about everything, I suppose, and not about circles. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the idea of the circle of learning has been long-lived and actually more important to the concept of encyclopedia because everybody thought that that's where the word came from.
Yeah,
Mortimer Adler then gives that, you know, instantiation in the Propedia. So you're absolutely right. We still have a vision of how things hang together. And I think the early Yahoo search engine actually mm-hmm. classified stuff. And every website was sort of like in a Library of Congress subject classification, U.S. government, and then divided into this and this and this. And your little web page in their search engine was at the end of a long chain of subdivisions. So
yeah.
And of course, I'm a big fan of library classification.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say libraries follow the same kind of classification, whether using Dewey or Library of Congress or whatever. They're great organized systems of information on the shelf.
Absolutely, and they bring things together that just searching for keywords won't necessarily bring together because there's so many different words by which you can talk about something. And keyword searching, like we do on Google, typically will only find the word, you know,
yes.
if it's not been used, like wealth and riches is a synonymy that one of my authors in the early modern period warns about. He says, if you're looking for this topic in my book, you should look under both terms.
Yeah, David Weinberger was on the program a few years back talking about his book, Everything is Miscellaneous, and he was uncomfortable with library classification systems. He really liked the keyword or free text sort of approach.
But I think we need both.
Yeah.
And at this point, because most people are more familiar with the free text approach, mm-hmm. I think we need to put in a plug to remember what classifications are good for.
Yeah.
They're not going to get you to everything you want, but like I said, we do have a sense of not always finding what we need. We need as many tools as possible. And library classification strikes me still as an important conceptual exercise. Obviously, there are choices to be made there, too, but there's a controlled vocabulary. That's the key thing, which helps people put things under a few terms. And then if you're informed about what those terms are, then you can spill the beans. My great way of using, I don't memorize Library of Congress mm-hmm. subject headings.
No, I do
is I use a library catalog like Hollis at Harvard, mm-hmm. which is open to everybody, mm-hmm. go in with a book I know I like. I want more like this, you know? And I don't use the Amazon also bought, although I do sometimes when I want to, you know, kill some time. And you find good stuff there, too. But a more systematic method of moving from one book to another similar one is to go into that subject heading, and then suddenly you are unleashed into the LC subject heading system.
Yes.
And can navigate. And of course, sometimes the subject headings have only one book in them, which is frustrating. And sometimes they have thousands, which is also frustrating. You really want the sweet spot where it's got, you know, 30 or 20 books that are well matched.
Yeah. Interestingly, the classification system supports an approach that privileges serendipity in the way that approaches where you're just going after an individual item and you only get what you know you want to get, provides. So.
Yes, that's exactly right. It only answers your query and doesn't make you aware of other ways of formulating your question that might get you good stuff. So I'm a big fan. On the other hand, just to say to go back to the early modern period a bit, actually, not all reference books were either alphabetical or systematic. Mm-hmm. I would argue that a bunch of books that are very large reference books with lots of information were self-consciously, miscellaneously arranged.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about the pleasure of variety that you will have, and they always supplied an alphabetical index. Right, so the index suddenly becomes the key to going in there looking for something specific. And if you want to just browse, you'll have a good time. And in fact, what they do is have sort of like an informal succession of topics. So I'm thinking here of Erasmus's Adages, for example, 4,308 or something like that. Proverbial sayings from antiquity, glossed by Erasmus, sometimes with some very long glosses where he goes off on all kinds of fascinating digressions about his time, one where he praises his printer Aldus, and another where he complains about all of the average printers who really are just in it for the money and are printing lousy things without paying proper attention to the quality of their work, et cetera, et cetera. So you can get all kinds of tidbits in there. But his work is, there's a train of association between one adage and the next one, but it's often very loose, and then sometimes they're just breaks, and you can't find anything in it from its arrangement, but you can through the index. And Erasmus himself worked on his indexes. We have manuscripts of the printed index of an earlier edition where he and an amanuensis, a helper, are working together to improve it for a later edition. So we can see that he really didn't just pawn off the index on someone else. He was actively involved.
Interesting. So compiling and organizing large chunks of information to make it accessible is one way to deal with overload, but there are other approaches to information management also. For instance, you mention Descartes' solution as something different, a different kind of approach.
Absolutely. The people I've studied who write reference books really exult in the overabundance. They're in the more is better optic. That's their mentality. And so their books are constantly getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And Descartes has the opposite reaction. He starts his discourse on method famously, really, by describing all the stuff that we fill our minds with as useless and not solid knowledge, only opinion. And he wants to start from scratch, from first principles, from an internal reflective process to build up truths that are self-evident, really, that are clear and distinct, as he puts it. And he says, for example, I've got a quote here from his Recherche de la Vérité, The Search for Knowledge, even if all science that we want to have were included in books, in which there is good stuff, there would be so much useless material confusedly put into such a great heap of volumes that you'd take more time to read them than we have to live our lives. And it would take more mindfulness to choose the useful things than it takes to invent them all over oneself. Basically, he's saying, rather than what people think is of as shortcuts, using books to get to knowledge, you shouldn't use books. Those aren't shortcuts. Those are long cuts. They will get you caught in the brambles of philosophers' disputes and so forth. The real shortcut is to think on your own feet in that stove-heated room and to strip away, to ignore, to just forget that accumulation of knowledge. Yeah, this having been said, that's a pose, of course. Descartes actually did travel with a book, in particular, actually, interestingly, a really chunky textbook of Aristotelian philosophy by Eustachios de Santa Paolo in the early 17th century. He was a migrant thinker as a soldier in the 30 Years' War, and obviously he wasn't traveling with a lot of books, and he didn't have access to a library and so forth, but we know that he at least had that one book. And, of course, he is offering a very different perspective, a new philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the principle, you do see it, in a sense, in the way science libraries and texts in the sciences, at least in the modern period, the 20th century, certainly were organized in that what science librarians are often focused upon is withdrawing materials from the collection and course, most scientific literature comes through the journal literature. It doesn't come through books. But what's important is what's been published in the last 10 years. And in fact, most of our science journals go over into storage after 10 years because it's assumed that whatever's in them is going to be outdated by then. You know, there's this notion that what's important is the principle that you derive from the information that's gathered, and that the information itself is going to become outdated very quickly and actually not only useless, but worse than useless.
Yeah, so, obviously different fields are different that way, and I think the humanities work tend to have a longer shelf life because people aren't all working on the same questions, and so a more recent approach needn't supersede an earlier one because they formulate the question differently, or they're working on another area. To think of history, for example, obviously there's so many areas of history that we really are just still beginning to write about. And, of course, interpretation also is something that changes over time and is driven by questions of our own time, inevitably.
Yeah.
I do worry a little bit about the idea that there's nothing in past science worth saving, because I think sometimes there are, well, you think of Gregor Mendel, for example, you know, whose article was based on genetics, was ignored for about 50 years before being rediscovered. And so, you know, what might there be in 50-year-old science now that we have lost because of this notion that everything useful has been done in the last 10 years?
Yeah, exactly. And science does seem to have come around full circle almost with data-driven practices now, where everything is being collected and saved, and we're sorry that we don't have data from former decades to look at also.
I'm a big fan of mindfulness. I mean, I think ultimately there is too much out there. You're not going to master it all. And the key thing is to create a mental grid, a mental map of what's out there, of what you're looking for, of what you want to accomplish now, so you don't get lost in it, you know? And you can't delegate to computers or to search engines the understanding of what you want to master in order to make a contribution. So ultimately, you know, the human brain is a key player in this information management, and I think technology can help, obviously.
Yeah.
It creates the problem, it's also the solution to the problem, just like printing created a problem and was part of the solution to the problem.
Yeah.
But we can't lose sight of our own mental education and formation of judgment, really.
Yeah, I just read a quote by a media specialist who took exception to the word machine reading, and he pointed out machines can't actually read. They can scan, but you need a human being to actually do the reading.
And I'd say, too, that reading isn't just a mechanical process even when it's done by a human. I'm a historian of the book, and history of reading is a fascinating subfield of the history of the book that shows how many different people read in different ways, at different moments even. We all sort of, I think, internally know that sometimes we're alert to certain things, or when your mind has been tuned into something, suddenly you notice it everywhere. It's probably not that, you know, it's just suddenly appearing everywhere. Suddenly you're noticing it. So it's about where your mind is when you read something that creates a reading experience. It's an interaction between your mind and what you're reading. And that will vary over time and with your interests and your level of attention and the kind of reading, the purpose behind your reading.
So in terms of the purpose of early modern reference books, especially the various kinds of compendium miscellanies we've been talking about, is the purpose of these generally to save time, you know, save the reader time by allowing them to absorb information by just reading snippets or summaries of longer works like we used to do with Cliff's Notes? You know, you didn't have to read War and Peace. You could read the 20-page, you know, account of War and Peace and Cliff's Notes and take the test and do very well on it. Or is it to relieve us of having to read it all by providing a place where we can go and consult for the information that we need when we need it? Or are these works meant to train the memory, essentially, so that they'd be a kind of medium between the text that they refer to and your own mind?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because I think different early modern scholars have different views about what the reference book is for.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, for the compiler and the publisher, the reference book is about making money. It's about selling copies.
Mm-hmm.
And you sell copies on the grounds that this is useful to all kinds of people. That's the sort of more is more, you know, more is better. There's something in here for everyone. How people actually use it, I think, depends a lot on who they are and those circumstances about access.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, one concept is that when you take notes, and most of these reference books, I argue, are basically collections in print of notes taken by someone on their reading, whether it's the individual compiler's own notes or notes that he has gathered from multiple people. The notes can either be especially when they're collected individually on a small scale, things that you want to reread over and over again and basically remember. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's a way of boiling things down so you remember that. And that's kind of study notes for an exam, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of that. On the other hand, the vastness of many of these reference books is so great, and actually many collections of notes from the early modern period that still survive to us will be dozens of volumes of mm-hmm. handwritten reading notes. Clearly, that's not the kind of note that anybody is remembering in extenso, right, exhaustively. Yeah. But these are indexed. So those notes are about offloading the memory, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a shift there. They always call it aiding the memory, right? Mm-hmm. Is it either aiding the memory because you give memory something to focus on that's narrow enough to be mastered, mm-hmm. or do you aid the memory by saying, okay, I put it in a notebook now. I don't have to keep it in my head. And certainly I behave that way with my Post-it notes and mm-hmm. a lot of my computer lists and so forth. You do offload things. As long as you know where to find them again, then you can try to relieve the memory. And that, I think, is an awareness that really becomes articulated in the late 17th century. The idea, really, that if you put too much in your memory, you are going to have less mental space for judgment, which is mm-hmm. more important. There's this great new book coming out by Richard Yeo called Notebooks, English Virtuosity, and Early Modern Science in University of Chicago Press, which is mm-hmm. all about that, about Locke and Boyle and these members of the Royal Society who worried a lot about how to keep records of these experiments, of their thoughts, share them with others, and also not get too bogged down in stuffing your memory with things. So they see themselves sort of like Descartes, with whom they weren't necessarily on the same page on all mm-hmm. points, but as sweeping aside a lot of that bookish learning that was characteristic, they felt, of early modern university learning.
So with note-taking, could you talk just a little bit about Harrison's note closet, which absolutely fascinated me as a machine for organizing information?
Absolutely. I think Harrison's note closet is described in print in 1689 by a man named Vincent Plachius, who's a German professor mm-hmm. of rhetoric. But we call it Harrison's note closet because Plachius was working from a manuscript, probably not the identical one, but that's currently in the British Library, but a close cousin to it, the same basic text, which we now think was written by someone in the circle of Samuel Hartlib named Thomas Harrison in the 1640s in England. In Latin, of course, so mm-hmm. these things circulate internationally that way. How exactly it got to Northern Germany for Plachius to publish it, we're not exactly sure. It describes a piece of furniture. Basically, I would think the point of departure is a European armoire, you know, a clothes closet. So it's human height, big doors, you open it up, and instead of finding space for hangers and shelving, you find these slats have little labels on them. They're in white lead on which you mark words, which are your headings, which will be alphabetically arranged just like they would be in a book. Mm-hmm. And on the back of each slat, under that heading, there will be a hook. And on that hook, you are supposed to poke your note slips. So this is a major investment, obviously. We're not sure that any more than two of these note closets were ever made, but Plachius describes making one. And we do know that Leibniz, who was librarian at the library in Wolfenbüttel, was given one. Mm-hmm. Not clear if he ever used it. Leibniz complained about having extremely messy papers and never being able to find anything again in them. And therefore doing the work all over again rather than trying to look for stuff. After, maybe the note closet came too late to shape his habits. So we don't really know how and if it was really used. Yeah. But the treatise that presents the note closet presents it as the perfect solution to this problem of note-taking in a notebook. You take notes in a notebook, you have to put it on a page that's bound in something.
Yeah.
You have to decide where it goes, and it's stuck there unless you want to copy it over again.
Yeah, and people used glue and scissors a lot, didn't they?
They did. Yeah. My bulk compilers were all about, but of course then, if you want to, you can cut up your notebook and glue mm-hmm. the note somewhere else, but then, of course, you ruined your notebook.
Yeah.
You can't share your notebook with anybody because it's got everything that's important to you. You can't give a little section to a mm-hmm. friend. And the whole point of the closet is you can work collaboratively with others. You can take the note slips that correspond to a particular topic, just take them off the hook, give them to your friend, they return them or not, oh well, the rest of the closet's still there. The friend wants to give you slips on a certain topic, that's great, you can add them to the closet, you can have groups of people working from the same set of notes very easily. You can move slips around, you can decide, oh, that's not the greatest heading for this slip, I'll put it somewhere else. and you can move it around. So mm-hmm. slips were used basically as soon as paper comes in, I think. Cutting and pasting from a manuscript was a key way of making an alphabetical list. You mm-hmm. would cut off the terms you want to index or whatever, and then, of course, you move your little slips of paper around until you're done. You're interfiling new batches, all that kind of stuff. And then when you're done, though, the slip was considered a very dangerous medium for saving your notes because, of course, you know, the slightest draft of air or whatever will disperse them, put them out of order. People can lose them without even realizing they've lost them. So the purpose of a slip was just to be a place where you alphabetize or sort, and mm-hmm. then you glue the slip into a page, and then it's safe. Yeah. So what's new about the note closet is this idea that you can keep your slips safely because they'll be, you know, you can close up the closet, they'll be on their hook, and you close up the closet and, you know, they won't be attacked by gusts of wind or anything like that. Yeah. And therefore, you can leave the slips as slips. In fact, you know, I can't say that it got much use. The library card catalog, though, is something that comes in the later 18th century in Europe. Vienna may have been the first place. There's a nice book by Markus Krajewski, now translated into English, called Paper Machines, which talks about basically the birth of the card catalog, which has that whole advantage of being able to move the cards around. Although, of course, then you have to have a little stick, you know, under the at the bottom of those boxes, you know, to hold the card.
That's so true. I can't tell you how many hours of my life I spent sitting in front of a card catalog, filing and revising already filed cards to make sure they were in the right spot. Because you know, you lose the card and you lose the book, as they used to say.
Absolutely. So cards, even the modern cards, have their drawbacks. Yeah. But nonetheless, that became a new way of note taking. I don't know exactly when it starts, but obviously the advice, you know, one fact per card on an index card is a way of taking notes for your history paper, for example, is widely taught in the 20th century to high school students. Yeah. And I know it's practiced still by some colleagues. And, of course, you get computer programs that will mimic card and print out cards and do all kinds of things for you.
Yeah. And it wasn't that long ago that when you were asked to do an index for a book, it was usually a matter of cutting up strips or writing out terms and then cutting them up and then rearranging them somehow, and sometimes with glue, before you retype them when you had to rely on a typewriter and you didn't have a word processor.
Yeah, I never indexed anything before that. For me, word processing came in when I was, for my use of it, it came in when I was a senior in college. So for my senior thesis, I wrote on a K-Pro luggable computer that weighed 30 pounds or something. I have spoken to colleagues, too, who remember writing their lectures by cutting from their notes. So they'd take notes longhand from books, and then they'd cut up the notes and glue them onto sheets, and that would be the order in which they gave their lecture.
Some of this culture may have made its way into the children's schoolroom culture in that one of the things we were always given when we were children in grade school in the 1960s was a bottle of mucilage, and we didn't quite know what to do with it, you know. I mean, there were times when we'd have construction paper, we'd cut the ribbons for Halloween and Valentine's Day, but supposedly they were supposed to have something to do with something we were learning in terms of learning to read, learning to write, but no one really quite knew why these bottles were around. And before that, there were the old, actually, glue pots that were plugged into the wall, and they had horse glue in them, and nobody knew what they were for, but they were supposed to be important. So,
fascinating.
So one of the things your discussion brings out is the importance of the printer in the creation and success of these works, which, when you think about it, is maybe obvious, because apart from their financial investment, which is an important element, the importance of layout, graphic design, and that kind of thing for the functionality of a given work is obvious. And also the notion of authorship itself is thrown into relief with reference works in particular, especially if the activity of compilation is something akin to, in our time, what we think of as information curation, as opposed to the idea of these things being created by inspired authors. Does this seem to be the case to you? And does your work resonate with scholars working with postmodern ideas about textuality and authorship?
Oh, that's a great question. On the first point about printers, I think you're right that reference books really pioneered a lot of the new methods of layout. So transition from manuscript to print, you lose color, right?
Yes.
Manuscripts often, especially reference books, used blue and red alternation, for example, to highlight initials for the first entry of a heading. You know, the eye-catching devices to guide you to what you're trying to skim through to find the word you're interested in, for example, or to separate different examples, or and so on. So all that color is lost basically once the modern book comes along. The very early books in Incunabula were often meant to be completed in color by rubrication, by hand, mm-hmm. but that doesn't last too long. As rubricators die out and everybody wants their book to be ready-made, who wants to buy a book and then have to spend more money to have color put into it?
Yes.
So then what printers use are dingbats, actually, brought to mm-hmm. us now by Word. And all these little symbols, you know, like the clover leaf or the chili pepper. mm-hmm. I have a right-facing chili pepper and a left-facing chili pepper. And the classical term was hedera, which is mm-hmm. ivy leaf, and it was used as a form of punctuation in antiquity. So it was also revived with printing. And then, of course, the pointing finger, what Bill Sherman calls the manacle, mm-hmm. which is manicule, I think, is really great because it's a pointing finger that says, look here, this is interesting. And the other key element, which is still with us, is white space, right? That you will have a paragraph break, have a heading break set out by white space so that the page becomes black and white rather than being colorful, but the white plays a greater role than it used to draw the eye's attention to the big breaks in the text and so on. And, of course, digital page layouts are still using those tools. They can introduce color again, which is nice. And, of course, they got all these flashing, moving things, too, which can be considered a distraction, actually.
Yeah.
Now, on the authorship versus compiling point, that's an excellent one, and it's such a rich story to talk about what authorship meant to different practitioners of it.
Yeah.
So one point to make, I think, is that compiling was not looked down on to the extent that it is now, you know, as sort of some second-class activity.
Yeah.
These compilers, they didn't all, but the biggest ones got their names on the title page, and they wrote prefaces, and they dedicated their work to people. And, you know, they were proud of what they did. They talked about their sleepless nights spent studying, working on this for you. So compiling, it's not quite such a harshly hierarchized environment. But yeah. at the same time, though, I do think to say that the notion of authorship really only comes in the 18th century is probably too late. We have plenty of authors who are articulating a strong sense of their own intellectual property on the one hand and their own hope for readers and even immortality through their work. 16th century poets, certainly, mm-hmm. Like Sidney and Spencer.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And, of course, Horace, well mm-hmm. before that, mm-hmm. who says his writings are more durable than the monuments of Egypt and the pyramids of Egypt. So I do think, though, that it's an interesting exercise to watch how early moderns deal with citation, which is not mm-hmm. at all in the modern way, not at all what we would value. They tend to cite only authoritative works, mm-hmm. things that'll make them look good to mention it, that'll help their cause. You don't cite your source because you want to show your work, as we hope that people do today, and acknowledge people who've contributed material or ideas. You cite the sources that will enhance the prestige of your work. Mm-hmm. That's typically the mode in which, you know, people will fish into a florilegium and they'll want to know that Seneca said this, or Horace, or the Bible, or St. Augustine said that. And otherwise, if it's proverbial wisdom, that's fine too, but then there's no author for it. Right. Mm-hmm.
So when you read about or hear people talking about information technology today, do you see patterns in discussions about the pitfalls and promises of present-day technology that align with your own historical reading? And is there anything we should keep in mind about early modern information management that might help us come to terms with information overload today?
Well, in writing my book, I made a file of a new kind, which I mm-hmm. called Places, following the early modern technique of calling your reading notes commonplaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so my Places file has headings, mm-hmm. and under the headings I have notes to myself about where in my notes, under the author's name, have I found something that's cool on this topic that I might want to come back to again. And, of course, so I feel that's kind of the notes on notes aspect. I take notes when I read a book, but then I go over them, or as I'm reading the book, I think, oh, this would be useful for that theme, or this would be useful for that theme, whether mm-hmm. I'm working on the theme or not. Of course, themes will occur to me after I've read a book, and then, of course, I've missed the opportunity to, and I often reread a book to look for material on a new theme that hadn't occurred to me earlier. Mm-hmm. So it's a constantly moving process. These places are never stable. And ultimately, when it's time to write, I really go through those headings and dump half of them or find that some of them are redundant or reshape the material completely. But I did find it useful to think in terms of that intermediate space where the thinking mm-hmm. happens, where the connections are being made between different things you've read in different contexts often, and that help you see a bigger picture and move out of the trees to kind mm-hmm. of see the forest and make a mental map that you can then share with your readers, with other people.
Interesting, in so much as your book, Too Much to Know, is in itself a kind of compendium, isn't it? And I mean, you've got so much in it in terms of it, material for examples.
Yes, and I probably still too much. In fact, I did cut the manuscript down, but it has a broad scope because I wanted to put the early modern period, the 1500 to 1700 focus, mm-hmm. in the broader history, especially the prehistory, as in, you know, looking at ancient reference books, medieval reference books, a little comparative with Chinese and Islamic, and there mm-hmm. would be many other potential comparisons to be made, to just make the point that writing a reference book and seeking to find information again and to store it safely is a constant, practically, certainly for written cultures, and I think one could make a similar case for oral cultures. It would be different nonetheless, but that's part of humanness.
Yeah.
And so we are facing these struggles too. And I suppose my answer for today, you know, what to do today about it is to use your mind to just make sure that you think about things.
Yeah.
And don't bite off more than you can chew at a time so you can actually digest it. That's a term that early moderns talk about, is digesting your notes.
Yes. Memory is incredibly important, remembering the past, rather than just trying to come to terms with problems like information overload without having any idea that you're not the first one to ever try to tackle this problem and that there's a history.
Absolutely. And one thing I do worry about the digital transition is, what are we leaving in the way of archives for the future historians?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, these notes taken on paper that were long neglected for centuries in between, they sort of sat in usually an institutional collection, sometimes in a family collection, and are available to us. Yes, they're a bit hard to read, and you have, you know, language and paleography and so forth, but nonetheless, they are amazing. We can really step into their working methods much better than we can into working methods of ancient or medieval authors, certainly. And I worry that it'll be true that these early moderns and moderns, who left a mm-hmm. lot of letters too, will prove to be much easier to study than we will be in due time. Because, as you say, we live in an era of information curation, and if you don't turn your own notes, update them into new software, mm-hmm. into new hardware platforms, you're not going to be able to read them, even your own things, 20 years from now.
No.
You know, let alone, gosh, what did I say, 20? 10?
Maybe the NSA will be our salvation if they're collecting all this stuff.
So. Well, actually, Matthew Kirschenbaum has a very nice book, Mechanisms, talking about how, in a way, for some people, information is extremely resilient. I mean, mm-hmm, the FBI can get information off of a hard drive, you know, under practically any circumstances. There's nothing you can do to a hard drive to take the information off mm-hmm. to someone who is determined and has a lot of means, obviously, to do so. So that's fascinating, too, that even as we can't access our old files because, you know, the new Word doesn't read Word Perfect or whatever and complains incompatibility. Mm-hmm. And so we throw up our hands. But if you put your mind to it, you probably can access it.
So, okay, last question. As a librarian, I've got a good sense of the meaning of so many books, so little time. And I know you talk in the book about how this can be understood in various ways, but I think certainly those of us who take education seriously, who work in the field, and includes students, of course, have this anxiety about the limits of time and memory and the vastness of the knowable still. And the knowable is, in effect, the unknown, the unknowable knowable, if you will. And although the library is still our collective information organization project par excellence, it's also the case that it's the very symbol of the fact that we dread that we can never possibly grapple with all this information. You know, libraries to undergraduates still, I think, often look like mysterious islands on campus looming over all of us, that indicates to us that this is what we're supposed to know and that we can't possibly do anything more no matter how much we read and study, but establish the thinnest sort of scrim along the edge of this massive territory. So ought we to despair of ever really knowing much of anything as individuals, I mean?
Well, that you've articulated a sentiment that goes way back. I mean, that is where the sense of overload is clearly experienced by the early moderns, and even by those before them. I think it teaches us humility. It's true. We're only going to know, you know, the thinnest scrim along the edge of what there is out there. But it's not a reason not to go where many have gone before.
No.
Doing our best to make sense of the world, to find what's important to us, and to pass that on, to transmit it.
Yeah.
Because there is a potential trauma of loss. It was experienced by the early moderns who realized it, and I think we shouldn't get overconfident. The loss can be the loss of humanistic skills, for example, mm-hmm. the loss of the ability to pay attention, to focus, to slow down, to think. And I think those are values we have to cultivate to keep our compass in mm-hmm. this vast ocean. And, you know, but the vast ocean is a privilege, too, that there's so much out there is thanks to the generations that have come before us and all the people around us who are usually doing great things. This is a lot of it, and you're not going to be able to digest it all. You've got to make choices. And I think you also have to leave yourself a little time. Reading the newspaper is never more fun than when it's a distraction, you know, a detour from something you should be doing.
Yes,
so I think you've got to do what you should be doing, but also let yourself wander a little bit on the web and come out with things that are meaningful to you and that you can share with others.
And it helps to think about the fact that knowledge is always a collective accomplishment, really, that we don't have to each of us know everything there is to know ourselves. And and to look at the library also, you know, this came out as we were talking, and it occurred to me anyway, if you think of the library as a system for knowing and not just a pile of things that we can't possibly ever come to grips with, it's a more positive way to look at it, I think so.
Absolutely. And there are people in the library, like you,
yes.
who can help.
Yes.
I think that's key.
Yeah.
So that there are other, and it's not just, and teachers and parents, I mean, the experts in general are people, are a key resource. And they were in the early modern period. That's what all that correspondence was about.
Mm-hmm.
Or some great books are also excellent guides to find a path that isn't over-intimidating. I think you can't possibly read everything. It's true, you know, graduate students come feeling they have to read everything on their topic. And, you know, there may have been a time when that was possible. You know everything about a teeny tiny thing. But now I think even on a teeny tiny thing, you can't read everything.
No.
And so you make judgments by using the advice of others, by, obviously, I'm a power user of our library, and I have 340 books checked out at the moment, which is rather excessive, but we're in the middle of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not saying that it's always a balance. You read different things in different ways. So I think one should try and taste and find out about what's out there, and then as you burrow in more deeply, you just have to give up on a lot of areas and learn them vicariously through others. Book reviews.
One thing the conversations we have in this program over the years bring out is how collaborative scholarship is, the enterprise of scholarship. I mean, we still have this idea of St. Jerome in his study with a lion sitting in the doorway, keeping people away so that we can be illuminated from above. But scholarship is today and always has been a collective endeavor. So,
absolutely. May it always be so.
So I want to thank you, Anne, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age.
Thank you very much. It was fun talking to you.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks.